You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. A word of caution for today's program. We'll be dealing with sensitive societal issues. Listener discretion is advised. Today, we're discussing transgender identities, an issue that has become the subject of political propaganda that has polarized Americans. Our goal in today's exchange is to demystify what it means to identify as transgender and gain a better understanding of the intersections of gender, race, identity, and political power. Joining me in the studio are Carrie Jean Soika and Kylan Matias DeVries. Both are faculty members in the Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies program at Southern Oregon University. Both are recipients of the university's Distinguished Teaching Award. Now, these two award-winning educators have co-authored a new book about the identity experiences of transgender people. The book is titled Transgender Intersections, Race and Gender Through Identities, Interactions, and Systems of Power. Welcome to the exchange, professors.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, yeah.
So it may come as no surprise to you both, but it surprised me to learn that more than 1,000 legislative bills across 49 states have been introduced just this year alone. And these bills seek to block trans people from receiving basic health care, education, legal recognition, and certain rights. That data comes from the Trans Legislation Tracker at translegislation.com. Now, out of 1,005 bills that are introduced this year, 122 have successfully passed into law. So let's start with a simple question. What does transgender mean?
That is a great question. And there are many different definitions out there, actually. One of them, I teach a book in one of my classes by Susan Stryker, and she is a really foundational scholar in transgender studies. And she talks about transgender as the movement away from whatever gender you were assigned at birth. We all get this assignment of gender at birth, right? We're like, oh, or sometimes even before. Sometimes it's, you know, like the pregnant person is going to the doctor and they're like, oh, it's a boy or it's a girl. You know, we have these gender reveals and all of that. Well, we have this assignment, right? And that works for a lot of people, but it doesn't work for everyone. So transgender is a term we use for a whole lot of people who find at some point in their life that thing that was given to them at birth or sometimes before didn't work for them in some way.
Okay, that sounds very simple. It's a movement, as in transportation, but trans.
Trans, yeah.
So it's a movement away from the gender that was assigned to you at birth.
Yeah.
Okay. And for sometimes it's thinking about it in terms of like binaries, right? So somebody who was assigned female at birth moving to being identified as a man and vice versa. But sometimes it's about like a non-binary identity. So sort of challenging or not feeling like that gender fits in particular ways. And so some of our classes talk about the variety under that category of transgender.
Okay. And the classes you teach here at the university, they've been going on for a while.
They have. And we actually developed a trans studies certificate back in 2020, which is quite popular. And we even have a decolonizing transgender class from our Native American Studies program to talk about the complexity with indigenous identity.
Okay. And it's quite unique, I understand.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Only one in the country.
Yeah. Okay. So why is this a political issue now? We've had politics for a long time in this country, and all of a sudden, this issue, transgender identity, is just kind of dominating.
Yeah, I do a lot of trainings in our region for different organizations and businesses and all of that. And one of the things that always comes up at these trainings is like, what is going on? Why are transgender people in the spotlight so much? And one of the things I often say is that trans people's lives aren't inherently political, but they have become politicized. There's definitely like a scapegoating. If you do a lot of analysis of it, there's a lot of people who are making trans people's lives seem like they are threatening, when really people are just trying to get through their days, right? Like they're just trying to live their lives in ways that feel authentic to them. But it has become politicized because some people are really concerned about this. They're really concerned about how people are living their lives. They're really concerned that people are living their lives in authentic ways when that doesn't match what they expect, right? It doesn't match that expectation based on what they were assigned at birth.
What is their concern?
That's a really great question. And I'm not sure we covered it. I think, you know, some of it goes back to, we have this very set idea of there's men and there's women. And when we have things that challenge that identity, it can seem very threatening to people. You know, so what is it? I think about sort of the crossover with intersex folks. So intersex folks are those who and please help me with the definition too, those whose bodies don't align with gender expectations. Mm-hmm. So if you have someone who is born intersex and everybody expects you to say, I have a girl or a boy, what do the parents or the doctors do in terms of identifying that child? And it kind of freaks people out, right, to not be able to label somebody a particular identity. And so as you have this expectation of I have a boy or I have a girl and this is how they're going to behave, what happens when that switches? And how do we know how to – we're not very adaptable or flexible. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you would add?
Yeah, I mean, gender is just so foundational in our world, right? Like we don't tend to question it very much unless it's something that doesn't work for us. One of the things that we talk about like – in a lot of our classes, in our book, and all of that is how this gender system that we have, the sort of understandings we have about gender, we think about them as very natural, very given. But if we look at other societies across time or even just across place like today, the way we think about gender here, like in Southern Oregon, it is not the same as other people have thought about gender, right? But because we think about it as really natural, because we think about it as a given that we shouldn't question, it creates these sort of like panic moments for people when they realize maybe this isn't a given. Maybe there are other ways to think about this thing. Maybe there are other ways to understand it.
So when you say panic, I think paradigm shift.
Yeah.
I'm okay with a paradigm shift. If I learn something that is new to me, and it opens my eyes and expands the aperture of my understanding. I think that's a good thing. I don't know how it affects me emotionally because I'm just that kind of person who embraces learning.
Yeah.
But I can understand that paradigm shifts can be hard for people. But panic? Why would anyone panic?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I think that I guess I would say the word panic because it's an emotional response that people have. So if I've known I'll give you an example. So I'm trans. I was assigned female at birth, and I identify as trans masculine. And if you were to look at me, my daily interactions, people just perceive me as a white man, right? That's how they perceive me every day. Mm-hmm. When I started transitioning, and particularly like my relatives and friends were switching using pronouns, right? It caused this real discomfort because part of it is, well, what if I mess up? I'm okay if you mess up. If you're trying, that's great, right? But it's also like, well, do I have to talk to you differently now? Because we do have gendered ways of communicating with people like, hey, dude, hey, bro, you know, opening the door for a woman, you know, sort of these expectations.
Right.
And so now all of a sudden I have to think about, oh, I have to do these differently. Because of the societal expectations around gender. And I think for some people, that's that panic. So what happens in terms of like birth certificates and driver's license? And we have all these systems. Our criminal justice system is based on two genders. Other institutions are based on two genders. Marriage is even based on two genders. So what happens then when we start to shift that a little bit? And I think for some people, it's sort of like this ripple effect, right, of like what's going to happen? I don't know what's going to happen and I'm scared.
Well, we've been socialized to treat men differently than women and mm-hmm. vice versa.
Yeah.
And so if someone identifies as transgender, it sort of short circuits our thinking, our socialization skills.
Yeah.
We don't know what to do with that.
Right.
But they're just human beings.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
My guests are Carrie Jean Soika and Kylan Matias DeVries. They are co-authors of the book Transgender Intersections, Race and Gender Through Identities, Interactions, and Systems of Power. In your book, Transgender Intersections, you tell the story of Lance, and his identity has multiple intersections. Tell us about Lance.
Lance, great story. So I met Lance like about 17 years ago, and then I got to re-interview him 15 years later. So Lance is Indigenous. He's a trans man. And when I was initially doing some of this research, I put out a call for trans-identified people of color, was the term I used at the time. And he emailed me, and he's like, so I don't know if I qualify because people perceive me as a white man now. And we began talking before I even interviewed him. And he started to explain how, as a child, he was, you know, often perceived as a girl or a woman and often as someone of color. So he's, because he's indigenous, he talked about how people didn't always recognize him as being indigenous. He would get a lot of the, where are you from? Meaning you aren't white American, right?
Did he belong to a particular tribe?
He did. And it was the Nakota. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he talked about going back to the reservation in the summers. And then as he physically transitioned, so for him, that meant taking testosterone, which masculinizes his features. He had this expression of, you know, my facial features have changed enough that they're more white. And he wasn't talking about his skin color. He was talking about how we use these embodied aspects of like facial hair and the color of his facial hair and this masculine way, which then people perceived him as only being a white man. So his indigenous identity was erased. And, you know, he talked about sort of this sense of loss of that identity. But then he also found this empowering way of like, wow, if people perceive me like this, that gives me an in. And I can talk to people about race and gender in ways that I wouldn't have if they perceived me as non-white.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So whiteness in America is also a social construct, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, you devote an entire chapter to it. So it must be important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we do a lot of work on intersectionality. It's this whole theoretical framework that goes back decades, primarily from Black feminists, but a lot of women of color scholars and activists. And intersectionality often focuses on multiple marginalization. And that's like a term that people use, meaning like when people are oppressed by systems like race and gender and class at the same time, right? But one of the really important things about intersectionality too is our ability to use it to think about privileged categories or things we call as privileged categories, right? Whatever is seen as the norm or that might get some extra benefits or all of that. So yeah, we have a chapter to talk about whiteness. But to not like have whiteness just be the invisible norm or the thing we don't say or talk about. It's about really bringing whiteness to the forefront and looking at white trans people's experiences just as in depth as we're looking at other places in the book at BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, People of Color, trans experiences.
Well, in your book, you wrote, quote, "White supremacy and settler colonialism shape all trans people's lives in the USA and in many other places as systems of power. While not all white and or settler trans people acknowledge it, they benefit from systems of white supremacy and colonization," end quote.
Absolutely.
What are systems of white supremacy?
So we can sort of think about that in terms of, I'm going to try to remember the person's name. So we had a white trans man in a rural area talk about how it's sort of this interesting situation that was happening where there were active white power movements in the rural area that he was living in. Lucas, is that it? And, you know, he talked about this interesting thing where people knew he was trans, right? So he's gender nonconforming to them. And yet, because of his whiteness and his masculinity and his working class, social class, mm-hmm. He fit in and there was this acceptance of him. Not that they were like socializing, right? But they were, what would you call it, neighborly?
Yeah, they were very neighborly. Like they would get along really well. And for that participant in our research, like he actually had that awareness. A lot of people don't. If you're white, you don't always think about your whiteness. But he was really thinking about his whiteness. He was recognizing that being white in this place with these neighbors who had like white power signs up and stuff like that, like really overt white supremacy, that he was able to kind of get along with them despite him being trans and despite them knowing he was trans.
Okay,
right?
So because he identified as white, he had proximity to power.
Absolutely. Yes.
So
yeah.
within that construct, he could then have a variety of different privileges, even though he was gender nonconforming.
Yeah. Right. And like Lance, there's this way in which he was also aware of this and he was able to like build these relationships to try to like over time shift people's understanding too, to try to get people to like understand where, again, people are just living their lives. Like this doesn't have to be a threatening thing.
Okay. So this is a really good insight into this issue and I'm starting to understand it better. I hope our audience is as well, but we need to take a short break. Now, before the break, we talked about the issues of gender, race, and systems of white supremacy. The label of race points to the construct of racial hierarchy, an ideology that values whiteness and devalues all non-white races, thereby supporting the idea of white supremacy. Now, this belief was established in the colonies before the nation was born. I want to introduce a new guy, a new guest to this segment of The Exchange. He's a dead guy. His name is Sidney George Fisher. He was a wealthy attorney, a constitutional scholar, an author, and a plantation owner. He was also a key endorser of Abraham Lincoln for president, and he wrote a book in 1860 called The Laws of Race. And here's an excerpt. Quote, "To understand slavery, therefore, we must study the nature of the white man and of the Negro. Out of the principles of their respective organizations, we may be sure slavery has grown and by them will be controlled. Those principles were impressed upon each by divine will, and the consequences that flow from them have the same source. Of these races, the white is the highest in scale, the black the lowest. The white alone possesses the intellectual and moral energy which creates that development of free government, industry, science, literature, and the arts, which we call civilization. The black can neither originate, maintain, nor comprehend civilization. He is by nature a barbarian. When in contact with the white race, he naturally and willingly yields to it and becomes its servant. The two races have exhibited these characteristics in all ages. The white race must, of necessity, by reason of its superiority, govern the Negro wherever the two live together." End quote. Your thoughts?
You want to go
ahead? So, I mean, this is one of the things. Yeah, I mean, this is white supremacy. This is, you know, like this embedded stuff that is still the legacies we live with today, right? Like we don't always live with them as overtly, but we are increasingly seeing this overt racism like that. I think about the really great thing that happens with intersectional scholarship. So like coming back to trans studies as well, I want to just mention this book called Black on Both Sides by C. Riley Snorton. And Snorton tells this history of blackness and transness looking through, like, you know, centuries worth of, well, at least a century worth of historical scholarship, and the ways that these are embedded together. These histories of white supremacy are also the histories of trans exclusion, or the ways that we think about this, like our system of gender is racialized. We don't often think about it as these like mutually reinforcing things, but they are. These ways that we think about both of these things come together. So when we think about intersectionality in our book, we're looking at a lot of individual people's lives, but intersectionality is also about these broad systems.
And I think about, there's a sociologist, Joe Fagan. He talks about how, you know, if we think about the creation of the United States, we can think about like a house. And if you know anything about houses, you know, you build the foundation for houses. And that foundation is built on systems of inequality. So racism, sexism, classism, right? And if you've ever lived in a house where you see big cracks in the wall, right, it can tell you that the foundation's not good. And you can take that house off and rebuild the house. But if you haven't fixed the foundation, it's just going to come back. And I think like in the book, one of the things that's, I think, interesting is because we're focusing on people's stories is we're talking about, so there's these big systems of racism and sexism, and how does that play out in people's lives? So some of the black trans men that I talked about knowing when they were perceived as black men and being acknowledged as black men, for things that other black men experienced, which was like particularly white women like holding their purses tighter when they walked by or avoiding getting into the elevator with them. And that didn't happen when they were perceived as black women. Not to say that black women don't experience racism, but it was a different gendered construct.
And there's not that fear factor.
There isn't the fear factor, right? And so there was this interesting like, wow, this is really confirming for my gender, and ooh, this is really problematic, and how do I deal with it? So it's about how it's a broader system that we grow up in, and then people enact those ideologies in terms of like interactions in the day-to-day basis. And so particularly for our trans folks of color, there's lots of information for white trans folks, but they're like, well, I didn't know to expect this. Who do I talk to about how to interact with people?
Well, there seems to be an irony here. Now, when you mention white women clutching their purse and showing fear of someone that they're unfamiliar with, and it's just a black man.
Right.
But the black man is not fearful of the white woman.
Right.
Or the white man. And so these people who are experiencing violence in these oppressive conditions, they don't seem to express the same kind of fear of the systems that are constantly creating that violence.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think about one of the stories of, I forget our participants' names sometimes, but he was talking about how he's moving abroad. He's leaving this country. He's a black trans man. And he talked about, he used this analogy of a fishbowl that, you know, when he went to this other country, he's like, wow, there was other black people there, and I didn't feel scared, and I didn't feel nervous, and people were just reacting to me as like a human being. And when I came back to the U.S., I felt like I was in this dirty fishbowl, and I'm going to leave. And there is actually some exodus happening with black people in general from the United States because of the racial tensions here.
But also trans people.
Trans people,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that like his analogy of that fishbowl is maybe so feels so poignant to me, because it's like these are the things that we exist in all the time, but he didn't really realize it until he had left and then come back to the space, right? When he comes back, he's like, wow, this I've been dealing with this the whole time, and this is so toxic to me, you know? Like, that's what he was kind of, I have this realization.
My guests are Carrie Jean Soyka and Kylan Matias DeVries. They are co-authors of the book Transgender Intersections, Race and Gender Through Identities, Interactions, and Systems of Power. Your book also deals with gendered racialization. What is that?
So when we're talking about that, we're sort of talking about the intersection of like sexism or racism or gender and racial experiences. And how this really came up is I interviewed a bunch of multiracial folks. And what was surprising to them and then surprising to me is that, for example, I had a few trans men who were perceived as white girls or white women when they were younger. And as they transitioned physically, so again, masculinizing hormones, they got like darker facial hair, right? And what happened to them is they were all of a sudden perceived as not white. They had this brown racial experience as men. And I think what's further interesting is the ways in which now, not only were they racialized, but they knew this because for these individuals in particular, white people would speak Spanish to them, and not great Spanish either, right? And so, and they talked about how if they were dressed down in like jeans and a t-shirt, that would happen more often than if they were dressed up with like a button-up, you know, shirt and looked like of a higher class. And so there's this ways in which, you know, whiteness was absolutely a factor in their gender identity earlier, but it didn't become as apparent until that shift happened. And it was still part of their racial identity, but it was how others treated them. And then just kind of what happened to their sense of self as they were, as they had this particular racialized experience. I mean, it really impacted how they thought about themselves in a very different way.
So that's very interesting. So you're telling me that from birth, as children, they were considered white girls.
Yes.
And then as they grew and understood their identity was moving away from that gender assignment, and they began this hormone treatment, it changed their appearance, and society was socialized to treat them differently as now men of color.
Yes.
And they realized there was a huge difference in the way society treated them just based on that perception.
Absolutely. I mean, they were always multiracial, right? That's the thing. They were always multiracial, even when they were young. But because of their, and if you read the book, you know, you get to know them a little bit more, right? But like, because of their upbringings and their specific contexts, they didn't have that sort of association with their multiracial identity as much. They just kind of had this white normative thing that's going on for them. And it's that gender racialization is about how, as their gender shifted, their experience of race shifted too. And this happens for, I think, lots of people, like all trans people who are undergoing some sort of change in how people perceive them, like your experiences are racialized as well. But for a lot of people, it's just considered normal. right?
You know, that's a very interesting term, because when you use the term white and then you use the term normative. So white normative is it's the normal, so-called normal, I'm using air quotes,
yeah,
here, position or condition in white America, and everyone else is expected to assimilate into that white normative culture. And of course, people of color cannot assimilate because we just have no ability to do that. And you just articulated that point. As people perceive you as a person of color, they treat you differently, and they're socialized to do that through this power structure.
Yes. Yep.
Now, the political landscape is leveraging the power of law in a battle against the trans community. What do you envision for the future of the trans population in America based on all of these new laws?
Trans people are very resilient, and trans folks and allies are fighting every day for better legal representation, better health care. Like, I think that we, you know, in trans community, people are talking a lot these days about trans joy and how we foster trans joy amidst these really intense attacks on people's lives, livelihoods, and ability to just be themselves. I think we are in a tough time, clearly. And I also am constantly talking to, you know, friends, community members, students. We're talking about how we make change that is going to help people's lives, and also how we find joy and community with each other as we move toward that change that we're trying to make.
Yeah, I think about so I have a one of my participants was named Scout, and he's a brown disabled trans man, and I love his quote, and I altered it just a little bit for the radio. He says, "Every day is an act of revolution by literally existing," and so that kind of feels like an FU to the system. You know, and his stories are like throughout the book, but this way in which, you know, he talked about the multiple oppressions that he experiences, and also, I'm here, I'm alive, and that is something to be said. And so we have, I think our last chapter sort of talks about like trans futures and how are trans people thinking about how to make, how to have joyful lives and support each other and build bridges across difference, right? In various ways.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of this political attack on the trans community is supported in the white Christian conservative community of our country. How can we bridge that communication gap so everyone sees each other as just humans?
Well, I think our participants would say, like, we need to find the commonality, you know, like, how do we can disagree about certain things, but where do we find sort of the common stories or experiences? Or, you know, I think about Lance talking about, you know, living in sometimes rural areas with folks who are very politically different than him and have different ideologies. And he just starts it with, like, getting up every day. I'm just going to have a good conversation with this person, and I'm not going to worry so much about changing their mind, but I'm going to make sure that they're questioning things. Did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is this piece. It's about solidarity. How do we find commonalities across difference, right? We don't have to be the same, but how do we find these moments where we do agree on some pieces? And this is something that is really big in a lot of social movements, right? It's understanding we can move forward together without the sort of being the same. And I think that as we think about bridging this divide, a lot of those conversations become so influential. Like conversations about Christianity, for instance, since you brought it up, like there are lots of Christians who are very trans affirming and wonderful, and how are they understanding it, right? How there are lots of people who are already in these spaces.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. I think we've come to the point that we agree these conversations to find common ground of understanding are important.
Definitely. Thanks,
well,
Mike.
Thank you both.